First case for argument is Beck v. Dabrowski. Mr. Isaacson.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Eric Isaacson for the plaintiff, Philip Beck, accompanied today by my colleague, David Wisbrocker. Pardon me. Given the limited time for oral argument, I'd like to focus on three main points, the first being loss causation, the second, whether negligence is a state of mind that is subject to Exchange Act Section 21DB2's requirement regarding pleading a strong inference of state of mind, and third, whether the complaint adequately alleges that the proxy materials in this case were misleading because critical information about the Vornado-Blackstone bidding war was provided by supplements that were mailed too late to adequately inform, or in the case of the third supplement, not mailed at all. Possibly yet to Colorado River abstention.
I didn't understand, just to elide some of those issues, I don't understand how this 50-cent higher offer from Vornado, when half of it was cash, could be considered the equivalent of an all-cash. I mean, it's terribly risky to get half your stock and half your payment in stock.
There's some risk there, Your Honor, but I believe that this Court generally recognizes that the market value of a security is...
That's not the point. The point is, it's not that the market valuation of securities is inaccurate. It's that there's a lot of risk, right? Cash, you have cash, you can put it under your mattress, and you're secure. But with stock, if you find yourself with a huge chunk of stock, one stock, and that's a very risky position to be in.
Well, there is risk there, Your Honor, no doubt, and that's a matter that shareholders would want to consider when they're evaluating the totality of the
circumstances. Yes, but when you talk about one of the things that bothers me most about your position is you kind of have a scenario in which a company can block a sale just by, you know, offering and making a new offer every day. Like, you know, you offer another nickel, and then your position is, well, you offer another nickel, so now we have to mail, we have to analyze the new offer a nickel higher, and we have to mail our analysis to all our shareholders and wait, give them a chance to digest it. And that delays the sale. Then a week later, you know, you can have another offer with another nickel higher. So how does this thing end?
Well, I think when you talk about a nickel, you're suggesting that an immaterial change in circumstances...
All right, make it a dollar.
Well, if we're talking about 50 cents or a dollar...
Yes, but look what suppose every week Vornado offers another 50 cents. So the consummation of the deal with Blackstone is postponed indefinitely.
If every week Vornado offers another 50 cents indefinitely, then the shareholder is going to be making a lot more money off of the transaction if they reject the Blackstone offer and accept the Vornado offer. So that, I think, demonstrates that this is information that the shareholders would want to know about, particularly in this case where you've got a starting bid from Blackstone at $48.50. Ultimately, Blackstone pays $55.50, that's $7 more. Vornado was offering another 50 cents above that. That's a substantial portion of the numbers that we're talking about here. This is material information, and you've got to provide material information to the shareholders.
I want to know is what was wrong with the information that was given to the shareholders. The initial proxy statement is enormous, and there's a great deal of information conveyed in it. The three supplements... You might be arguing one of two things. You might be stressing, particularly with respect to the third supplement, the fact that it's only 24 hours and it's posted on posted on websites and so on. Or you might be complaining about the quality of the information in it. And I don't see that the quality of the information in these statements is something that should be criticized. I mean, the various prices are there. Any stockholder who wanted to could see that there's a $56, even if you accept your position that the stock is equivalent as opposed to $55.50. They can do the math. if it's a timing issue, then I guess we get to the question, a similar question what Judge Posner was asking, don't we need to look at all the circumstances, how much publicity there was about this? Would the stockholders really have cared that much at the last second?
Well, on the question of whether the shareholders would have cared all that much, that's a question of materiality that the Supreme Court indicated in TSC Industries is a mixed question of law and fact.
But it doesn't, the Supreme Court has never said that you can never, particularly post-PSLRA, that you can never have a judgment without a trial on a materiality issue.
What the Supreme Court says is that a statement is, or information is material if it would affect the total mix of information that was available to shareholders. When we're talking about information in proxies, I think we're primarily talking about whether it changes the total mix of information that shareholders were provided by the proxy process.
So tell me about the third supplement then. What's material about that?
Well, the third supplement is indicating that Blackstone's coming in again with an additional increase in the price. It illustrates the fact that you have a bidding war here, and shareholders evaluating the total circumstances up to that point could reasonably conclude that the longer you cause this bidding war to go on, the longer you wait, the more money there is going to be available. We've got a company that has very valuable assets, $15 billion of which...
They couldn't tell that already by the second supplement?
$15 billion of which were almost immediately liquidated. They don't have the final offer from Blackstone. No,
oh, I know, but they can tell. They know by the time the second supplement's filed that there's a bidding war going
and
on.
The second supplement comes out 9 days before the
and it reflects
February 7th
the fact
vote.
That there's a bidding war going on.
Well, it reflects the fact that there's a bidding war going on, but we're talking about only a few business days. We're talking about a company where a lot of people are holding a street name, where the notice is going to be mailed by regular U.S. mail that typically takes several days.
How long do you think the company has to wait after mailing the information?
Well, we argued before the district court that it probably ought to be something like 14 days. So that there's time for the information to get to shareholders who are holding it directly and evaluate it, so that there's time for shareholders who are holding for holding in street name to have the information get to their stockbroker, get passed on to them, and then have them have the time to change their proxy votes.
But the SEC has never passed a regulation. I mean, the SEC has lots of regulations in this area. It sounds like you're asking us.
The SEC has, well, no, I'm asking that you not take away from them.
Well, no, you're asking us to add a 14-day rule regulation.
Well, the SEC says it's of overriding importance that shareholders be given timely and accurate information of material changes. The SEC says that it may be delivered in electronic format.
It's too vague what you're saying.
Results in delivery.
It's too vague.
I,
no company, if you prevailed in this suit, no company considering a sale would know where it stood.
Well, I think the court could make it very clear by saying 10 to 14 days.
Well, but that's Judge Wood's problem. We're not the SEC.
Well, the SEC indicates that there's going to be information.
Well, go to the SEC and ask them for a 14-day rule.
SEC says the information needs to be delivered.
Go to the SEC, ask them for your 14-day rule.
Your Honor, the rules require full disclosure and accurate disclosure, and I don't think that happened
here. This is just a litigation trap.
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to move on to the point of loss causation, where the Supreme Court has indicated that loss causation, we have to, you know, draw a connection between the violation that we contend was committed and the loss that we claim. The district court held that there was nothing in the complaint to suggest that the shares might have been worth more than the $55.50 that Blackstone paid.
So I want to go back to a point that Judge Posner made a minute ago, because, frankly, even reading your brief before I got to the red brief, I was having trouble seeing why a $55.50 cash offer had to be regarded as worse than a $56 cash plus stock offer. It seemed to me that a rational person might consider them at a minimum equivalent, if not the cash offer, better. So I want to know what loss. The district judge was concerned that your pleading had not really spelled out the loss, and I'm not sure whether the loss is the 50 cents per share or whether the loss is some theory that had this company not been taken over at all, it would have been worth more, and if so, where have you pleaded that? Or whether you think that Vornado would have come up with a higher bid? Where's the loss?
The loss here starts at the 50 cents a share. The district court said there's nothing to indicate that the stock was worth more, or that the shares were worth more than $55.50. Here's Vornado's offer at $56 a share. Accepting market price and market value is value. There it is in the complaint. We also indicate that we thought that the shares were undervalued, even at that, given the fact that the acquirer was able to flip $15 billion basically a week after the shareholder vote.
I don't understand why that's so important, actually. And I might note that the district judge's opinion mentions the $56 per share. He knows that it's $56 per share payable, he says, $31 per share in cash and the rest in stock. But why is the fact that they can convert some assets into cash afterwards? You're not alleging this is a transaction that doesn't reflect real value, are you?
Your Honor, transaction reflects some value. I'm not asking you to sit.
So they have money instead of office properties. What's the difference?
I'm not asking you to sit, Your Honor, as a trier of fact. This is a Rule 12b-6 motion. I appreciate your point that a shareholder might conclude that $55.50 was a good deal, or might conclude that $56 was better. The point is that the shareholders were entitled to be fully informed of all of these events in advance of the shareholder meeting.
Well, the $56 is not closed as quickly as the $55.50 deal.
No, it's not, and that would go into the evaluation that a fact finder would have to make,
but the
Your Honor.
The proxy statement said that.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there was disclosure. In terms of loss causation, you've got to tie up some flaw in the proxy statement.
A supplemental proxy said that.
Yeah,
a supplemental proxy. Okay. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve what's left, if I may.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Isaac.
Thank you.
Mr. Graham?
May it please the Court. My name is David Graham, and I represent the individual defendants here. This morning, Your Honors, I'd like to address two issues among the various grounds for dismissal. The two issues are loss causation and whether the complaint adequately alleged a false and misleading proxy statement.
Could I ask you, though, first to address this timing point? Because I'm concerned that the district court judge has mixed up two things which are, in fact, different. One of them is the fact that in today's world, it's quite possible to get information very quickly through all sorts of Internet-based sources. And the second is the idea of personal notification. I don't think the point here is whether a letter was put in the mail with a little card attached to it with the supplemental proxy statements, but I don't see anything in this record to suggest that records were kept of shareholders' email addresses, that there was any effort using these fast methods of information transmission to get the word to them. It's just, if we've posted on the SEC's website, we assume people are sitting there day and night monitoring the SEC's website. And what evidence is there that that's true of most of these shareholders?
With respect, Your Honor, that question comes from a false premise, and that is, Your Honor would be right if what was done here is simply a posting on the SEC website and then see whether people pick things up. But that's not what was done here. And what was done here was that immediately upon each of the offers and counteroffers taking place, there was a press release released to the world.
Right,
such
a press release and then articles, right?
And
in
articles,
the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times
and
so on.
That's not passive activity on the part of the company. That's active activity in terms of putting it out.
But it's not the same as sending a letter to everybody.
It is not the same as sending a letter to
everyone. Or an email, for that matter.
Absolutely, Your Honor, because they don't have all the email addresses and letters can take time. And the fact of the matter is that when it comes to the initial proxy statement, the SEC does require a personal mailing of that sort. The SEC has deliberately refused to adopt any such rule with regard to supplemental proxies precisely for the reasons that Judge Posner has indicated. These can be fast-moving events, and there is risk to stockholders if there is delay. And therefore, the only question becomes, is the means adopted one that prevents there from being something that's false or misleading to shareholders? At the end of the day, the cause of action here is under Rule 14A9, which is, have the shareholders been deceived? Somebody has to have been deceived. And when the information gets out through a press release, universally through the market, and this, Your Honors, recall, this was the largest single buyout of all time in U.S. history. It was front page in every single media outlet and immediately transmitted. That's more than sufficient. And the SEC doesn't say anything else.
So there's some presumption, if it's in a lot of newspapers, that the shareholders are paying attention to it.
Well, there is, I think, some presumption of that. And, in fact, the case that they cite, United Paper Workers from the Second Circuit, says that the court on a motion to dismiss can take constructive notice that if something is universally in the papers, that that provides notice to your shareholders. And, by the way, the same thing is true, Your Honor, just to give another example. In the SEC, in the Rule FD, the disclosure, when they require that there be an immediate publication at the same time so as to not have selective disclosure, they allow it to be by press release, but with the assumption that it reaches the shareholders in the market. Any other rule in this day and age would be inappropriate, and what they're asking you to do is precisely a kind of policy rulemaking, which is completely wrong here.
Do we know anything about the distribution of share ownership in the company?
We do. It's not off record, Your Honor. As you would expect, in a situation of this sort where you've had an offer out there for months, it's all in the hands of arbitrageurs. In terms of what the stock is.
It's all in hands of what?
Arbitrageurs.
Oh.
ARBs.
You mean they buy a controlling interest, you mean? Or what?
Yes, they would have a controlling interest, but that's not a record, Your Honor. But that's the fundamental point here, Your Honor.
Well, I don't see why that's different in today's world than it has been for a long time. If putting a press release is out is enough, we have actually had functioning newspapers in the United States for quite some period of time.
That's absolutely true. I think the way that media gets communicated and the speed is something that has changed, and the SEC's own rulemaking proceedings in various quarters have recognized that. The touchstone here, and I've gotten away from loss causation, obviously. Look, the touchstone here is, at the end of the day, were shareholders actually misled or deceived? Did they actually not know something? And look at the fiction you're being asked to assume in this regard. That shareholders were unaware of the fact that Varnado had made a $56 offer. Now, as we pointed out in the court below, as we pointed out here, there is no allegation in this complaint that shareholders were actually unaware. And they cite Mills. And Mills has nothing to do with this. It's a very, very different point. Mills has to do with the question of if a material omission has been established, as it was by the district court on summary judgment in that case, if a material omission has been established, can one then assume transaction causation? That's a violation, and then they said, yes, you can legally presume transaction causation. The question here, though, is the first one. Is there a violation in the first instance? That's not a matter of legal presumptions. Mills says nothing along that sort. That's a matter that there has to be actual deception under Rule 14A9. And that's exactly what this complaint does.
Well, suppose we had, just to oversimplify this case a bit, suppose we had a situation where the disclosure says that there's a $55.50 per share offer and the disclosure fails, and again, I'm changing the facts, I'm aware of that, and the disclosure fails to say anything about a $56 offer that in all respects is the same offer. It's cash, it's the same time frame, it's the same everything. I would imagine that failure to disclose would create the loss causation from the proxy violation that we're looking for. Now, I've changed the fact. In other words, the proxy statement fails to say that there's a better offer on the table, right? And then so people approve the $55.50 offer.
It would create transaction causation. Loss causation may be a different matter.
I think that one might even create loss causation. Of course, they're different. We know that.
The only reason, Your Honor, is because it depends on what the $56 really is, for example.
Well, in my hypothetical, though,
if it's $56
it was
cash,
the same offer.
Oh, I misunderstood.
cash. It was the same time frame. It was the same everything. There, I believe you would have loss causation.
I agree, Your Honor. If it were also a cash offer, it would be the same thing.
For, and then now we can start building back your complexities, because I understand, maybe you can clarify this for me, there were some other uncertainties about the Vornado offer in terms of when it was likely to really become firmed up.
Let me shift now. I think we've shifted the conversation to loss causation. So let me shift to that portion of the argument. You're absolutely right, Your Honor. The Vornado offer was an offer that not only had a 45% stock component, and you know, just as an aside here, there was some prescience, and it wasn't just prescience. It was a recognition that they were at the top of the market. Vornado stock tumbled subsequently, as anyone looking at
but
the stock
can't
record.
Add, we can't take that into account.
It's not necessary in terms of this. I understand, Your Honor. in terms of the loss here, there was a 45% stock component, and the deal was subject to a shareholder vote by Vornado shareholders, and all of it would take some place, some months in the future. Now, on loss causation, there are essentially two arguments here, and they're really quite simple. One is that the fact of the matter is that their claim about Vornado's going away comes down to the termination fee. And in that regard, the complaint itself, I think if you take a look at paragraph 50, the complaint says that the $720 million termination fee was designed to and did act as a preclusive provision for Vornado. I'm reading from the complaint. And in fact, before the shareholder vote ever occurred here, Vornado walked. And they put out a press release on the morning of February 7th that read, first sentence, Vornado Realty Trust announced today that it has terminated its fully financed definitive proposal to acquire Equity Office Properties Trust. Vornado concluded that the premium it would have to pay to top Blackstone's latest bid, protected by a twice-increased breakup fee, would not be in its shareholders' interest.
But don't you think that can be read as simply saying they weren't going to sweeten it any further, the $56 as packaged was as high as they were going to go?
No, Your Honor. It announced that they were terminating their proposal, and that's what was reported in every newspaper that morning, as a matter of fact, in terms of immediate reporting on the news outlets. So Vornado's departure from this scene took place not because of any shareholder vote. It took place, they terminated their offer. It's, as Your Honor knows, an offer and acceptance, if you pull your offer, it's pulled in a contract situation, saying it does it. And that's what happened here. So when they complain about Vornado going away, they don't want, they say don't pay any attention to that 8K. Of course, the court's own rules, the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure and Federal Rule of Evidence 201F, say that the court can take judicial notice at any stage of the proceedings, but even below we cited the articles reporting that Vornado had pulled its offer the morning of the meeting. So as a result of that, now maybe it was a breach of fiduciary duty, which they alleged, which drove Vornado away in terms of the termination fee, and you've got some complaint about that, but that's not linked to any proxy violation. And that's the end of the matter. And that's why below, in the court below, they abandoned that argument. They didn't even try to make an argument in the court below regarding the fact that the Vornado 50-cent offer was lost. Instead, their argument below, and that's why Judge Leinenweber addressed this, shifted to an argument that, well, you can imply from our complaint, even though we never allege it, that continuing ownership would somehow have been more valuable than $55.50 in share in cash now. That was their argument below, and they're repeating it here because they abandoned that below, and they've got no answer to the argument that Vornado walked before the shareholder vote.
Well, that's the aspect that Judge Leinenweber commented didn't have anything concrete attached to it.
Not only is there nothing concrete, there's not even an allegation in the complaint that continuing ownership would have been worth more, and he commented on that too, Your Honor. And so now in their reply brief, they come up with yet another scenario, which is unpleaded and speculative, and that is, well, who knows, maybe somebody else would have come along and bid more. I respectfully submit, Your Honors, that under Durham, that doesn't pass the test, because even Durham made clear that even under notice pleading principles, and particularly in the securities law context, where one is concerned about interim lawsuits that do nothing other than waste time, you have to indicate some factual basis for your allegations of loss causation. So the only one here that's pleaded is Vornado. Vornado leaves before the shareholder vote, so there's no link to that. Anything else doesn't have a factual foundation. Your Honors, each of these is an independent ground for sustaining the dismissal.
You said something in your brief about their having abandoned their class action as to some issue, or what is that about?
Yes, originally, Your Honor.
It's still a class action.
No, yes and no. Yes and no in the following sense. Their federal claims were never brought as class claims. Their federal claims were originally brought as derivative claims. They abandoned that derivative claim so that the federal claims are now solely individual actions.
Just Beck.
No one else. The only putative class claim here is the state law breach of fiduciary duty claim, which is precisely the claim that the Maryland courts have adjudicated and found that there was no breach of fiduciary duty with that matter
being.
That's still no word
from the appellate court?
No word, Your Honor. The Maryland Special Court of Appeals still has that in front of it. Unless there are any further questions, Your Honors, we respectfully request that the judgment of the district court be affirmed and what is really a frivolous complaint be dismissed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Graham. Mr. Isaacson, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honors.
You know, when you said in your opening argument that if Vornado came back every week with a 50-cent increase, that would be worth waiting. But wouldn't this fee that Blackstone was charging, which I think got up to $700 million something, wouldn't that keep rising month after month as Blackstone was suspended waiting for finality?
Well, yeah, if these folks are trying to ram through a deal.
Now, is there anything wrong? You speak rather derisively in your brief about deal protection fees, but doesn't that make perfectly good sense? I mean, if someone like Blackstone or anybody commits to some major purchase, they don't want to be whipsawed indefinitely as the putative seller goes looking for better deals elsewhere, right? That ties up Blackstone. So I can't see anything wrong with having a deal protection fee, and obviously it would rise as the seller, as EOP, pursued more or was pursued by more and more suitors.
The fact that Blackstone felt compelled to escalate the deal protection fee up to $750 million so quickly, I think, is an indication that they understood that there were likely to be additional bidders at higher prices. That's an indication
EOP has to make a judgment. Every week that it delays while it's flirting with Vornado, it's going to have to pay this huge fee to Blackstone, this growing fee to Blackstone, if it ends up going somewhere else. Well, isn't that a matter of business judgment? How long you're going to keep the bidding process going?
Your Honor, they have to agree to the termination fee, for one thing, and they're obligated.
Of course, but they don't want Blackstone to walk away. They don't want to say to Blackstone, well, we don't want to pay a termination fee, so Blackstone will go away, and then they're left with just Vornado. That doesn't sound right. Aren't these deal protection fees common?
Deal protection fees are fairly common. These are rather large ones, given the fact that $750 million...
It's a very large transaction.
...is the better part of $1 billion.
If Blackstone thinks it may have to put up billions of dollars in cash, huge billions in cash, it's got to make all sorts of arrangements. It's got to turn away other business offers. It has to arrange for borrowing and so on. It can't just dangle month after month without compensation.
These are issues of fact, Your Honor, that I submitted for a trial
of
fact.
Issues of fact? What do you mean? You want to have a trial on whether $720 million was too large a deal protection fee? You have an exaggerated notion of what the actual competence of the federal judiciary is to delve into these esoteric business issues.
Maybe we'll get a jury to do it, Your Honor.
A jury? A jury to decide the appropriate size of a deal protection fee? You're kidding.
Your Honor, I see my time has run.
All right, but we asked a lot of questions. If you have another point you'd like to make, you can.
I'd like to very briefly address the argument that Philip Beck didn't allege that he was personally misled. I think that is addressed in the Mills opinion in footnote 5. It's addressed by the Ninth Circuit in Stahl versus Gibraltar, 967F2nd 335357, Ninth Circuit opinion from 1992. SEC has taken a position when it comes to informing people by internet and the like. Release number 33776, he says, and I quote, "Not all security holders have access to the internet. Even those that do have access would not have noticed that a tender offer for their company's securities was posted on a website." And while a new rule 14A-16 says that shareholders can opt in to internet notice, there's no showing that that was done here. The rule says the website address relied on for compliance under this section may not be the address of the Commission's electronic filing system, which is what defendants are relying on in this court. And it also says in subsection M, this section shall not apply to a proxy solicitation in connection with a business combination transaction. So the SEC has taken a position that the kind of notice that they are contending was adequate is not adequate to the shareholders. Finally, with respect to the assertion that Vornado's announcement that it wasn't going to proceed any further was in the newspapers on the same day, I don't think that's supported by the record. I don't think it's indicated in the brief. It, you know, was something that may have been in the newspapers the next day while the shareholders were actually voting. But I, again, don't think that that's adequate information to the shareholders in a timely fashion. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson and Mr. Graham. And we'll move to our next case, which is